Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Hannah Dorr from NASHBE, and welcome to today's webinar, 2016 State Medicaid Housing Partnerships, State Examples. Before we get started, I'd like to go over just a few logistics. Your line will remain muted for the duration of the webinar, but if you would like to ask a question or leave a comment, please use the chat box on the lower left-hand side of your screen. The chat box will not be seen if you're in full screen mode, so make sure to exit out of full screen mode if you'd like to ask a question or leave a comment. There will be additional opportunities to ask questions and provide feedback periodically throughout the webinar. After the meeting is over, please complete the evaluation that will pop up after you exit the webinar. This will allow us to continue to improve your experience. And with that, I'll hand it over to Melanie Brown to get us started.
Thank you, Hannah. Welcome, everyone, to our first national dissemination webinar for our Medicaid Innovation Accelerator Program, State Medicaid Housing Agency Partnerships track. The purpose of today's webinar, we hope that you'll walk away from this webinar having improved your understanding of the benefits of state Medicaid and housing agency partnerships that can foster community living opportunities, that you'll also be able to identify additional types of collaborators for these partnerships, that you'll learn about promising practices to develop and build cross-agency partnerships, and that you'll learn about state strategies for effective coordination between services and housing partners. So the agenda for today, first you're going to hear an overview of the 2016 Medicaid Innovation Accelerator State Medicaid Housing Agency Partnerships Track. After that, you will hear from both Oregon and New Jersey, who were two states that participated in our 2016 cohort. We worked with eight states, and you'll be hearing from two today. We will then have some time for questions and answers, followed by a few closing comments. So up first, speakers today, Steve Eichen is our research manager with IBM Watson Health, one of our contracting implementation partners, but he's actually not able to be here today. So you'll be hearing from Melanie Starnes, a consultant with IBM Watson Health. And then from Oregon, you'll be hearing from Mike Morris. He's a behavioral health policy administrator with the Oregon Health Authority. Also from Kenny LaPointe, who's the public affairs director in the Oregon Housing and Community Services. And Lisa Sloan will serve as the moderator. She's a senior policy advisor with TAC, the Technical Assistance Collaborative, who is another of our contracting implementation partners. From New Jersey, you'll be hearing from Joe Bongiovanni, who's the Director of Managed Long-Term Services and Supports and Contract Logistics with the New Jersey Division of Medical Assistance, and Janelle Winter, who's the Director of the New Jersey Department of Community Affairs and the Division of Housing and Community Resources. Kevin Martone will serve as the moderator. He's the Executive Director for TAC. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Melanie Starnes for our overview.
Well, hello, everybody. Thank you for taking some time to join us today. I hope you find this an informative and useful use of your time. So I wanted to share a little bit about the State Medicaid Housing Agency Partnerships track and to share with you how things went last year. You're obviously going to be hearing from a couple of the states a little later on with more details about their experience. And hopefully, as you're working in this area, whether through IAP or otherwise, it'll provide you with some information that will help you along your way. So this partnerships track is intensively focused on building collaborations between state Medicaid agencies, state housing agencies, housing finance agencies, public housing, and other service provider or other agencies and service sectors as well. The first cohort, the first track that we did with this was last year. It ran from May through December of 2016, and you can see on the screen there were eight states that were selected to participate in that first go-around. And again, you'll hear from folks from Oregon and New Jersey in a little bit later in this webinar. The IAP does a lot of work in a lot of areas, and one thing that makes this particular track fairly unique is the close relationship with federal partners on planning and coordinating this. You can see on the screen there's a number of key partners, federal government agencies like HUD and Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, also known as SAMHSA, the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation, which is in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services as well, sometimes known as ASPE, and then the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness. And all of these, we are working together with all of these federal partners, including CMS, of course, at the federal level, and hoping that some of those partnerships that you're seeking to build at the state level between Medicaid, housing, and other resources will, this will be helpful. And we're really appreciative of these partnerships because they also allow us to provide a broader depth of technical support to all of you. The goal, really, for this track and for these partnerships is to foster community living opportunities as a direct result of the support that that states receive through the IAP experience. So taking a look at what states were focused on in the first cohort last year, states focused on different populations, and some of them focused on multiple populations or issues. So therefore, you know, the numbers don't add up exactly to 8 states. But 7 out of 8 states that participated had some focus on people who were homeless or chronically homeless. And you can see at the bottom there also people who were at risk of homelessness. A couple of states were including that. 4 states were looking at serving people with mental illness and those with substance use disorders. 3 states were specifically looking at the housing needs and how to serve people with complex and high utilization needs. And then another 3 states were also looking at people who are transitioning from community settings, transitioning to community settings, from institutional settings, including people who might be involved in the Money Follows the Person program. And so you can see by the numbers there that several states had multiple populations and areas that they were focusing on through their IAP work. So some of the key accomplishments, and you'll hear more from Oregon and New Jersey in a little bit, but in general, some of the accomplishments were the establishment of cross-agency partnerships. Some of the cohort states came with some foundation and partnerships, but other ones were establishing brand new partnerships and were able to develop those more fully through the IAP. They were able to align existing housing and healthcare initiatives and kind of pull some of those things together into more of a systems reform or a more comprehensive approach rather than having just a bunch of disparate, unconnected pieces of work. There were also, some of the states were also develop or expand their data matching efforts to target resources better. So they were looking at examining costs and outcome by matching and comparing data from the Medicaid Management Information System and the Homeless Management Information System. You saw in that slide before, 7 out of the 8 states had some serious focus on homelessness, so the HMIS was and is a useful tool in many states that were where it was heavily used. And then also some states were looking at managed care data and comparing it with HMIS and seeing how they could better target their limited resources. Okay. Some other accomplishments included identification of resources for additional community living opportunities, how they could involve entities and perhaps leverage resources that might be at the local level or other kinds of partnerships, maybe with veterans organizations and things like that. And then engaging with these other key stakeholders, not only local public housing agencies, but landlords themselves and county service agencies, managed care organizations, and other types of service providers. Okay. So as we mentioned, you will hear up first, we're very excited to have Mike Morris and Kenny LaPointe from Oregon, and they're going to share more about the work that they've done over the last year or so. So Mike, we'll turn it over to you.
Yep. Thank you for this opportunity to talk about what's happening here and development of relationship with Oregon Housing and Community Services. And so initially, I mean, we have had quite a crisis in housing that has resulted in increase in homelessness, and we're particularly interested in individuals with disabilities and experiencing homelessness together. Then in 2000, well, actually before 2016, but in 2016, we developed our Oregon Performance Plan in conjunction with the U.S. Department of Justice investigation, and an Olmstead investigation into our state, and there were some definite focuses on supported housing and increasing that opportunity here in Oregon.
And this is Kenny LaPointe with Oregon Housing and Community Services. Mike and I are here sitting in the same room, kind of pinging back and forth. But sort of following up on the performance plan with the U.S. Department of Justice, we had a national study that came out of Oregon, actually out of the Portland area, done by the Providence Hospital Systems Center for Outcomes Research and Education, which really started to back up with data the need for us to do a lot more of this cross-sector work. And the data was showing us that for folks who are living in housing, just by coordinating healthcare and other social services, that we would achieve anywhere from a 12% to a 17% cost savings per member per month for folks who had coordinated services for them. We had already had a relationship with the Oregon Health Authority on the HUD 811 program, and I think it's worth mentioning that when Oregon applied twice for the HUD 811 program, the first time that we applied, the response that we got basically said that our partnership with across systems, so the partnership between the housing agency and the state Medicaid agency, wasn't as strong as they would have liked to have seen in the application. And we, you know, we're happy to say that we were awarded the 811 program as we began to improve our partnership, which has slowly gotten better over time.
So with the IAP, we developed a core team of individuals from the Oregon Health Authority. Rick Wilcox, who is our Olmstead coordinator, headed up that team. And then we had representatives from the Department of Human Services looking at housing for individuals with disabilities. And then, of course, with Oregon Housing and Community Services. So one of the things we need to make sure is, and we did from the moment that we applied, is that we had support and buy-in from agency leadership. That was really key for us to move forward. We didn't want this to be an isolated kind of thing that staff did, but really was incorporated into the vision and the direction of our agencies in moving forward regarding housing.
And as we got more buy-in from agency leadership, the IAP work really helped push us forward on identifying cross-system strategies that would increase supportive housing opportunities in the state of Oregon. We are further working on those strategies, and we've actually, I'll kind of talk in a few minutes about a work group that we've formed, but we're really looking at opportunities to utilize our Medicaid system to finance the services in supportive housing, and also looking at adding additional policies within our qualified allocation plan at the Housing Finance Agency that would further incentivize our developers to really integrate supportive housing units into the developments that they're doing. Additionally, through the IAP program, one of the goals for us was to convene stakeholders from across our state and our IAP consultants from TAC, who were wonderful to work with throughout the process. Lisa Sloan and Sherry Lurch were phenomenal to work with, and they came out to Oregon, got a chance to visit our beautiful but rainy state. And we convened a group of folks that were from the public health system, the Medicaid system, our managed care organizations, our continuums of care, housing authorities, community action agencies, to really gain additional support from them as we do the work in Oregon. And I think everybody would imagine that all these folks at the table were very much engaged in this conversation and still are engaged in some of the work group stuff that we're doing. We also had the opportunity to learn from some other states, and particularly Connecticut was one that we were very interested in because of the great work that they were doing on data sharing. And so we're looking into, we're We're moving forward on establishing a cross-agency data sharing agreement, which is actually going to be further expansive than just the Oregon Health Authority and OHCS. We're also including the Department of Human Services, and we're also in some talks with Education and the Department of Corrections to see what we can do on that front.
So active interagency coordination, actually stopped for a few months, but not for very long, actually. But we continued our relationship and working together. Real quickly, we had a waiver request, and in that waiver request, we were looking at some housing opportunities and using Medicaid authorities for that. That part of the waiver was not approved, or rest of our waiver was, but we have this continued to move forward, and so that Kenny can talk about that group that's been formed as a result of that.
Yeah, so we are right now standing up a supportive/supported housing work group that is jointly staffed and funded by both the Oregon Health Authority and Oregon Housing and Community Services. We felt like the jointly staffed and jointly sort of financed piece was really critical into how this work came off to our partners across the state of Oregon. We really felt like we were making a statement and leading by example by doing that. But we have this work group that will begin meeting in July with representatives from across the state of Oregon. So they're stakeholder partner representatives with state agency staff supporting the work. And we're also going to be looking at engaging a consultant to help us through this process. But the idea of the work group is that we would get recommendations from our partners and stakeholders, and one set of recommendations would come to Oregon Housing and Community Services, and it would be what policies can you put in place as the state finance agency to incentivize and increase the supply and development of supportive housing in the state. And the other piece is recommendations to the Oregon Health Authority on what potential waivers could be pursued to help support the financing of supportive services in that housing. So that work group is exploring those policies. We'll be evaluating best practices from across the country, not just in the state, to see, you know, what we can do around those policies. So that's very much a part of the charter of the group, and we're looking to move that forward. I also referenced the work on the 811 program, which we're continuing to move forward. We are starting to place units after, you know, a lot of states have struggled with the 811 program, so we're really working, moving forward and working well together on the 811 program and starting to get units in place at this point in time. Additionally, the state legislature gave Oregon Housing and the Oregon Health Authority some money to collaboratively work together to bring more supportive and supported housing to the state of Oregon. Actually, we'll be making recommendations to our policy oversight body and funding oversight body next month, and we will have funded over $10 million in supported and supportive housing development across the state. Additionally, we will be putting out another $13.2 million for supported and supportive housing, particularly for veterans who are experiencing a severe and persistent mental illness or a substance abuse disorder. So we'll be putting that money out this summer. And again, those are collaborations between both of our agencies. So there was stakeholder input provided into this process and good partnerships on the ground that folks in both of these agencies are basically out in the field working with partners to ensure that they're able to connect together. So putting our housing developers in the same room with our managed care organizations to make sure that we can get the right partnerships in place to make the housing successful.
Mike and Kenny, it was really great to hear about Oregon's significant accomplishments, all about the Oregon Way, and how, and especially how you're not only continuing to collaborate, but here, 6 months out, you're really seeing the benefits of the collaborative process. So I had a couple questions I was hoping that you could talk to the folks on the phone about. So first of all, around the supported housing work group, who's going to be on that work group, and how did you decide who should be, you know, who should be there, who should be at the table?
So we decided as a collaborative, so between the Oregon Health Authority and Oregon Housing and Community Services, we've had a lot of conversations and gone back and forth on who should be on this group. We felt like there should be good statewide representation, addressing the needs around supportive housing in rural Oregon is a very important piece of this work, and we're finding that our rural areas definitely lack the capacity to do this work, and so we have some specifically chosen rural representatives on this group. We have folks from our managed care organizations or coordinated care organizations who are represented. The Department of Corrections, so we have some reentry housing providers in our state that do supportive housing for folks coming out of incarceration, and so we have somebody who's from that system who is represented. We have folks from the hospital system. We actually have a recipient of services that is on the advisory group, continuum of care, so an individual who represents a good majority of our state for continuum of care is going to be on this work group as well. So we have kind of a good swath of representation of both housing and social service providers from across the state.
Thank you very much. You talked earlier about collaboration between state housing and human service agencies. What could you say are some of the challenges that you had in collaborations that other states may also experience, and do you have any recommendations for tackling those challenges?
Well, I think one of the things that, at least from the agency level, is healthcare and social services speaks a different language than housing folks, and so so we're learning the language. You know, we always talk about in healthcare about the Medicaid managed the information system, MMIS, and so we're learning about their, you know, information system. But it is really it's been a challenge to get the providers of the services in connection with developers so that they can partner together on projects when we have funding that's available. So we've had to go a couple of rounds of funding to get the money out there. And so Oregon Housing Community Services with OHA sponsored, some technical assistance, conferences to kind of educate the provider of services and the developer, getting them together to understand what they need to do to come together to be able to put forward a viable proposal.
And I would also add that on that same language thing, I think that is probably the biggest upfront issue is just the separate languages of the systems. We did work across the state of Oregon with our managed care organizations, coordinated care organizations, to have we'll call them health and housing forums, where it was really a breakdown of the language barriers, where we had our housing folks in communities sitting on a panel with folks from the healthcare system and just talking about, what do they mean when they say continuum of care, and what do they mean, how does a Section 8 voucher work, how does the Medicaid system work. So we've had a lot of those cross-sector convenings across the state, which have really helped to kick off the relationships across sectors, and those relationships continue to improve, and we're starting to see more organic partnerships come in for competitive funding rounds with our agencies.
And we do also plan on going forward as an outgrowth of the IEP is to continue those technical assistance visits into communities, bringing the service providers and the developers and the housing providers together to facilitate the building of those partnerships.
It's hard work, but it sounds like it's paying off, and you've really kind of done midterm adjustments as needed. You're very lucky you have some capital dollars that you're using. Do you have any advice for state housing and service agencies that want to do collaboration but might not have any new money?
I think you can definitely garner the support of the advocates, which is where the capital dollars came from that we received in Oregon. And there's some additional requests coming in our legislative session right now for additional capital dollars. I think whenever you can be as creative as possible, you definitely want to go that route. And if in any way possible to link funding systems to existing funding systems. So for example, we're utilizing 4% tax credits with our mental health housing dollars. So a portion of, larger developments are being dedicated to folks with mental illness or substance abuse disorders. And the remainder of the units are, for folks who are 60% and below AMI. And so sort of combining those two, which also helps us achieve some of the goals in the Oregon Performance Plan around community integration, have really worked well and help you make a project whole. So the limited amount of capital dollars that were available and the money that the legislature gave us was not going to get an entire project done, so we had to bring in other resources.
Thank you very much. Thank you both. I think Mike and Kenny will be available after we talk about New Jersey for some questions that Melanie will bring up. But I'd like to pass it along for the New Jersey discussion to Joe Bongiovanni, please.
Good afternoon, everybody. So I want to just take a moment to say I've been doing the housing thing for a little bit less than a year. I have our partner from DCA, or Department of Community Affairs, Janelle Winter, on the phone with me. Janelle, you want to give a brief introduction?
Sure. I'm the director of the Division of Housing and Community Resources at the Department of Community Affairs. We're our state housing agency. And among other things, we administer the state's Housing Choice Voucher Program, our state rental assistance, some other housing assistance programs, some housing production programs, and our homelessness prevention funds, among many other things. So we wear a lot of hats on the housing side.
So some of our goals for participating in the IEP partnership track for 2016 was to draft a proposal for supportive housing for Medicaid-eligible individuals who are experiencing or at risk of homelessness. We wanted to try to ensure that we know who Medicaid folks are who may need assistance with housing, to drive support to them with respect to housing, understanding that if you can stabilize housing, you can most likely stabilize or maintain appropriate health.
I think an additional goal that we had was to identify new and leverage existing funding sources to support supportive housing. And I think one of the things that we learned early on in pursuing that goal is we had a real need to educate ourselves and each other, especially about the existing resources, to really get a firm understanding of what's out there in a variety of different places, because there would be no way we could understand where the gaps were and think about new if we didn't really have a good handle on what was out there existing.
So to support that, obviously you're going to need to be looking at data. And we are in the midst of attempting to combine data, as Oregon had mentioned, Medicaid recipient data with homelessness data, to make sure that we are making policy decisions based on what we know from a data perspective, to know what folks on Medicaid need by way of housing and what folks who are homeless may need by way of Medicaid services, and sort of use data to drive that cross communication of the difference between medical services and housing services.
And finally, the Department of Human Services and the Department of Community Affairs have, and also our state housing finance agency, HMFA, have been working on various projects together for many years. We've come together for various initiatives and partnerships. which is a great thing. But one thing I think we really wanted to use this format for was to really push more towards working not just on special partnerships, on special projects as they came up, important as those are, but really looking to move towards a more integrated system and embedding the needs of the populations we're looking at within those mainstream systems.
So some of the accomplishments that we were able to get to during our 2016 participation in the IEP was establishing a consistent interagency partnerships with open lines of communication. And we wanted to know, as Oregon mentioned, you know, Medicaid speaks a specific language, and folks who are professionals in the housing world speak a specific language. And how do we get together and know where the experts are if we have questions and if we need to resolve an issue, be it housing or Medicaid health services? And we have established a couple of go-to people in all the worlds, not just you know, housing and Medicaid, but mental health, individuals transitioning from institutions through our Money Follows the Person project. There is a good collaboration amongst all those players to know, okay, if I have this question and I don't know the answer, but it sounds like it relates to housing, I can call someone over in housing. If I need to know about institutional transitions and I'm not the expert in that, I can call over to our Money Follows the Person program. And we are familiar with one another enough to know, oh, yeah, let's talk and problem solve. You know, and that consistency helps move an individual's quality of life to a place where they're not kind of repeating themselves three or four different times to get what they need.
I think we also use this process to develop a better understanding of what our resources, our opportunities, our challenges, our gaps were across the state and across agencies. And I think one thing that was really helpful to us was a tool and a process provided by our IAP coaches, which was a really detailed crosswalk of what our resources were in every area, what they were, what the requirements were, who administered them, how they were used. And I think I would say in at some points it felt like a really painful process to really tease out all this information, but it ended up being incredibly valuable. And I think everyone who was in our room at one point or another said that they really learned something new. And I find that it's a tool that I myself consult sometimes, even once we're done, you know, putting it together, because there's information there about where certain resources lie that maybe I didn't know about before and that I've shared with some of my colleagues as well. So that process was a really valuable one, I think, in terms of helping all of us really understand how are we doing this in each of our agencies and how could we do it together?
Absolutely. The next thing we have also done is we've begun work through Rutgers on the data analysis project related to housing on how do we match up and analyze Medicaid information with homeless information to, again, advance the cause of where do we put Medicaid services and where do we put housing services based on data. How do we improve the program to improve the lives of people who need it, whether or not they need medical services to maintain themselves in the house, or they need housing services to maintain their health. You know, and lastly, it was a collaborative process to identify what's needed to provide supportive housing to somebody with long-term care needs, including pre- and post-tenancy services. We had a very informative conversation, again, with our partners from the Department of Community Affairs and our Institutional Transition Services Program and our Division of Mental Health Services to talk about what does it take to become a tenant, what does it take to stay a tenant, you know, what are some rights and responsibilities, what are some services, both from the housing perspective and from the Medicaid perspective, to be sure that when a person is looking for housing, that search is successful. And then when a person has identified housing and becomes housed, their tenancy remains successful, both from the medical perspective or Medicaid perspective and the housing perspective. we wanted to do things that would avoid sort of a revolving door, like I get housed and then I have something happen and now I can't stay housed. Those sorts of things were definitely top on our mind when we were talking about what do we need and how do we develop a program for that.
And just to jump on that, I think one thing that was really helpful for us on the housing side was the opportunity to provide feedback about, you know, where we see people struggling as they attempt to lease up a voucher or as they move in or as they are a tenant, where we see them, you know, we're not experiencing them from the behavioral health side, from the service side. We're seeing where they are having issues that might lead to potentially to eviction or might lead to them not being able to lease up a voucher and losing that voucher. And so being able to kind of provide our perspective on what tenants were struggling with and think about how to shape a benefit in that way, I think was, it was a really pragmatic discussion for us. And I think we got a lot of insight from our partners on why some things might happen. And I think we were also able to give some insight as to what it looks like in kind of like the real property management housing world.
So our continued efforts after the IP sort of ends, and I don't necessarily know that in New Jersey we would ever consider that it ends because we've developed a work group that's going to continue to meet, perhaps not with participation officially from CMS and others, but things that we want to do as a group, and this group was formed as a result of the IP, is to develop contract language. Oregon sort of mentioned before, we brought our managed care organizations in, and that's sort of our next step, is to, we recognize that a lot of the way at least the Medicaid program works is through managed care, and a lot of what our managed care organizations here is related to housing, yet they don't have any clear guidance of what they're supposed to do or how they're supposed to do it officially in a contract. We say to them that they're supposed to be involved in institutional transitions from a care management perspective. They're supposed to be learning from our Money Follows the Person program about what it takes to do a housing search. But there's nothing really formalized, and I think what we need to do is further the partnership between the state and our managed care organizations to ensure that everybody understands whose role is what and how important the managed care organization's role is in advancing the cause of supportive housing, both from a housing perspective and from a Medicaid service delivery perspective. Again, that buzzword, social determinants of health, if a health plan understands what our work group understands is, you know, you successfully house someone and you support them from a housing perspective and you support them medically, their quality of life is better, and it's easier to serve them. It may be more cost-effective to serve them in that way if their successfully housed and managed care organizations understand what that means and what it takes.
We were also able to really work together on outreach to our stakeholders and implementing some of the work that we do. One of the first goals we had was thinking about supportive housing services for Medicaid-eligible individuals who are homeless. And one of the things that we were able to do at DCA, we have really good relationships with the continuums of care. And New Jersey, unlike many states, does not have a balance of state. We just have many continuums of care across our small state. And because we do homeless prevention funds at the state level and, you know, operate voucher programs, we are often in communication with them. And some of our partners at DHS and at Medicaid were not as familiar with the continuums of care, and they were not as familiar necessarily with the work being done at that level. So we were able to host a convening for the continuums of care in DHS, and the division leaders really came and gave some great presentations about what's in the future for the division and how they're working on this issue. The continuum leaders were able to talk about the issues they're struggling with on the ground and how they're addressing them. And it was really just a great way to open up some relationships that maybe hadn't existed or weren't as strong before. And that's certainly something that we all decided at the end of that meeting that we want to continue to have on a regular basis so that we can keep working together to address the issue of homelessness in New Jersey. I think another area where we worked together really well was in the past 12 months, we opened the Housing Choice Voucher waiting list statewide, and then we also opened the State Rental Assistance Program statewide. And in our HCV list, we have a preference for people who are disabled. in the SRAP, or the State Rental Assistance Program, we've been set aside for people who are disabled or homeless. And one of the things we were able to do was work with the various DHS divisions that were participating in IAP, make sure they really understood the voucher, what a voucher was, what the voucher process was, and understood the process of the waiting list opening and applications, and were really able to talk with the people they worked with, making sure that they understood how they could apply for this resource, and really helped us as a housing agency make sure that we were really reaching out to everyone who wanted to hear about this opportunity. And we really saw an increase in submissions for the waiting list by people with special needs. And that was really something we wanted to accomplish, and we're really proud of that, and we're really grateful to our partners for helping us achieve that.
All right, thanks, Janelle and Joe. That was really good stuff. Kevin Marton, folks. You know, what's interesting to me, I mean, you know, I'm at TAC now, and I've been here for a few years, but I had the opportunity to be serve as the Deputy Commissioner for Human Services in New Jersey for several years. And, you know, back in 2005 or so, when I came in, we had an opportunity to start to pay a lot of attention to housing, and we actually had a pretty significant influx of capital dollars, and the governor and the legislature had created a special needs housing trust fund with a really significant amount of dollars. And that money sat over at the Housing Finance Agency, and we quickly had to pull together folks to figure out how we were going to really organize, you know, the use of the capital dollars and getting services to folks together. And, you know, when I think back at the time, there was a lot of energy around it, but it was very task-oriented or, you know, very focused on specifically, you know, that issue at the time. And it's nice to see, you know, now several years later, and I think certainly accelerated through the IAP program, you know, how far you guys have come in really, really establishing those relationships. You know, it really seems now that you have this housing and healthcare equation embedded, you know, really in upper levels within, you know, not only the Department of Human Services and sort of weaving in the importance of housing, but also on the DCA and HFA side, the importance of healthcare-related services and helping people succeed in their tenancy. And you can really see how far you guys have come in sort of incorporating that as a shared responsibility across agencies. And I think that's just so key to what we've been trying to accomplish throughout this initiative. A couple of just follow-ups I think I wanted to throw at you guys. Can you talk a little bit about the peer-to-peer learning experiences that you experienced, you know, in New Jersey, but also maybe some of the things that you had to offer other states, whether it's, you know, related to Medicaid or housing services, and maybe even specifically, I know there was, you know, some really good conversations with Hawaii throughout the process.
Sure, I can take that. I had a conversation with Hawaii, who is attempting to, write housing into their 1115 waiver, and they had a conversation with our technical assistance coach, Lynn Kovich, who put them in touch with me over housing. And really what we did was walk through how'd you get started? How did you even know who you needed to talk to? And, you know, for folks listening on the phone, it was more about, well, okay, we know that housing is important from the Medicaid perspective. We know that Medicaid services are important from the housing perspective, and how do we develop that collaboration and start talking about moving the program forward. A lot of what we talked about with Hawaii was just the nuts and the bolts. Who'd you talk to? Well, you know the director of DCA. Pick up the phone and just have a start-off conversation, you know, and get people in the room where you need to know the questions. You know the questions, but you don't know the answers, and you might know where the answers lie. For example, your ombudsman or your housing, mortgage, and finance agency or your Department of Community Affairs. And those folks who speak the language that you need to understand but you don't necessarily know.
Janelle, anything to add there?
I think just the point there, and I know our colleagues from Oregon touched on it too, about you know, different ways to develop a common language between your healthcare systems and your housing systems. And I think one of the things when we did some of I forget what we call them, were they the convenings in D.C. where different states in the IEP where we all came together and talked, that was a common thread too, and something I was able to hear some of my peers on the housing side talk about, different ways in which people were able to come together and kind of learn to speak each other's language, and that was valuable.
One of the things that we came up a lot in the IEP process was sort of, the cross-agency at the state-level partnerships and really tying this together horizontally. But then there's sort of the vertical up and down, down to the local level. And you guys had done, that work with the local continuums of care and assistance, and you talked about that a little bit, which is terrific. And can you talk a little bit, Janelle, about, how you see that helping going forward, maybe even improving access to services and housing, maybe, reducing redundancy or overlap? Because, obviously the folks that, we serve, the Medicaid beneficiaries that we serve, don't fit in any one, box or a system. They're really, they're really touching so many different places, and we want to make sure everybody's on the same page. And sometimes those state and local level conversations and partnerships are even harder to tie together.
And I think that is one of the most difficult things that we struggle with is we're used to tagging people with a label and saying, oh, well, you should go in this store if you have this label. And, of course, people don't fit neatly in boxes, and we wouldn't like it if they did. But, unfortunately, so many of our resources are shaped in boxes, and all of our people get used to dealing within their box, within their lane, staying within their lane. And that's not just thinking about, the local continuums of care and providers, but also thinking about, for instance, staff in the field office who are administering voucher programs and who are used to looking at them in a very specific way. And I think one of the things that we can help people understand is, first of all, the variety of resources that are out there. And to think about, I think one of the most important things is to, if people know there's a spectrum of resources and how they might be able to get at those resources, then people try, it becomes less vital for people to try and force, a square peg into a round hole. Had a conversation recently where I heard from someone who had said that they had a person who was at risk of homelessness, and they had gotten advice from someone that said, well, I've heard there are these vouchers coming out, but they're for people who are chronically homeless, so maybe if you could become homeless for a year, you could get it. Well, that's horrible. And we don't want anyone thinking that way, but when we kind of slice our resources that way, we don't know about what else is out there and how we might access them, that's what people get used to thinking. I've heard of this one thing, and how do we get into that? And so I think the more we can talk to both our own employees up and down the line, and then also our local partners, our providers, our public housing authorities, our continuums of care, about everything that's out there, and then also learn more about the gaps, too, and how we might either, if we have new resources, address those gaps, or how we might look at our mainstream systems and say, are there ways we can be more flexible or ways we can tweak something a little bit, change it a little bit, that'll help address this issue where there's, where we really do have a true gap and there's nothing there to help. And I think that working together in this process has helped us understand that a little more.
Thanks. So, Melanie, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thanks, Kevin, and thanks to all of our presenters from Oregon and New Jersey. We do have some time for additional questions, and we've gotten a few questions in the chat box. And I'll start with the questions that came in during Oregon's presentation, and our speakers from Oregon can feel free to jump in, but also if our speakers from New Jersey have anything to add or anyone from our program implementation team, please feel free. So the first question for Oregon was around why your interagency coordination stopped for a few months.
Now, I would say that we took a brief pause on the IAP work, but we had numerous other bodies of work that were taking place at the same time between both of the agencies. So I wouldn't say overall that the collaboration stopped. There was just a lot going on. Legislative session opened at the same time. So I think there was just other work that was happening between both of our agencies and then outside of our agencies that limited the work that the IAP team could be doing.
Thank you. And the next question that came through for Oregon was, have discussions occurred about how to better link Medicaid services with existing housing, including tenant-based voucher holders?
Yeah, that's definitely been a part of the conversation. And our housing authorities, so our state housing agency does not administer Section 8 vouchers for our state at all. We have a project-based voucher program, a PBCA that we administer, and we actually have put into our agency's strategic goals for the year to have a lot more conversations with our owners, the owners of the projects that are doing the PBCA, on establishing preferences for folks with SMI or SUD and or chronically homeless. And then tying services to them. So we've had those conversations with our PBCA owners as well as with our housing authorities on bringing, we've actually incentivized them in our QAP and through other policies to bring in tenant-based vouchers into developments that are done, particularly with the $20 million or the $10 million that we had mentioned earlier. And then with other development dollars that we're putting out there. So we're asking our housing authorities to contribute some of their voucher resources to really help stabilize the folks that would be coming in and receiving housing, receiving supportive housing, recognizing that they're likely going to be 30% and below income earners and they need that stability in their lives.
The other thing I could say is on the Medicaid side is our coordinated care organization model is we incentivize outcomes within the system. So one of the things that we, through, for example, the CORE research, disseminating information to show that if the coordinated care organizations, the CCOs, would invest and provide housing supports that they can then improve their overall health outcomes that they're trying to achieve and that they're incentivized to achieve. So there's been some work with that. And Kenny, in a former position over at Oregon Housing and Community Services, was out there doing a lot of talking with CCOs about the importance of housing and how housing can improve health outcomes.
Melanie, it's Kevin. If I could just jump in. You know, this is an important issue for systems to really struggle with. You know, you think about in any given state, the target populations that, you know, states may be thinking about, you know, and, you know, what types of housing options they're in. And, you know, we had alluded to earlier sort of the crosswalk exercise where, you know, you're looking at, all right, you know, what are the Medicaid authorities you have in your system? What are the, you know, who are the people that are being served in your system? And what types of services do they need versus, you know, what's available now in their systems? And, you know, it's important for states to go through that exercise so that they can really try to match those services up with folks, you know, who are in housing or who may get housing, who need those services. And so it's not like there's any one answer. It's very localized to states, you know, but it's definitely an important exercise to go through.
That's an important point, Kevin. In Oregon, the CCOs have a bucket of funding in their capitation that's called flex funds for them to be able to use those funds to for other things that are not directly healthcare services, but and housing supports are one of those things that they can use those funds for. There have been some administrative issues that, you know, discourage actual use of those funds, which we have cleared up in our new waiver, but so we were encouraging. But we did go through the template and do an assessment of our current authorities And even though we were not able to get housing support specifically in our 1115 waiver, we are looking at our other state plan and other Medicaid authorities that we currently have that we can capitalize on or go through a process to expand some of those authorities for housing supports.
Thank you. So I noticed that there's a couple of hands raised. Because of the number of folks that we have on the call, if you do have a question or if you're having a technical issue, we do ask that you enter that into the chat box. We do have a few more questions. We'll get through as many as we can. So the next question, I believe, was for New Jersey. And the questions was about what are some of the issues that tenants struggle with? And I think that was in reference to the last bullet on your slide that talked about accomplishments during IEP, the 2016 track, where you said that you'd identified specifically what's needed to provide supportive housing to someone with long-term care needs, including pre- and post-tenancy services.
I think thinking about it in terms of the pre- and post-tenancy services, I don't know that any of the needs are particularly surprising, but they are absolutely needs. I think when we see people who are struggling to lease up a voucher, you know, to not lose it, but to actually be able to lease it up, we see people who are in need of assistance with housing search, with compiling the documents that they need to complete their application, with negotiating and with landlords if there's issues around, you know, credit background, a criminal background, et cetera. Security deposit, funds for furnishings, like anything that's going to help someone find and get into an apartment in a timely fashion. And then once they're there, there may be issues around their tenancy. They may have issues in paying their portion of the rent or in negotiating an issue around their unit or an issue that arises with their landlord. And so one of the things that we want to do is think about what sort of services could be provided that will both help people be able to, if they when they're able to obtain a voucher, to be able to use that voucher, and then to be able to sustain their housing and, you know, really improve their lives.
Thank you. So the next question is for New Jersey and Oregon. The question is: do you monitor the healthcare needs of the Medicaid beneficiaries in the housing programs? Are they assigned navigators?
So this is Joe from New Jersey. I can speak to our long-term care population. I don't necessarily know that we would call them navigators. Our health plans or MCOs that operate in New Jersey have care managers, and they monitor health status. They do frequent check-ins with the members in the long-term care program to make sure that services are going well, that everything is doing okay. We're looking at how we might expand that, but we haven't gotten anything specific as far as monitors, because our program serves 1.7 million people, and how to target folks is still a topic of discussion.
Thank you. Anything to add from Oregon?
So in Oregon, one of the things we manage directly, the Oregon Health Authority, a rental assistance program, and part of that rental assistance program is we fund a residential specialist, but we also fund a peer specialist to provide supports and work with an individual who is in the housing program, and if you want to call it, caseloads are really small so that they can provide those supports and kind of monitor what's going on. There are some other healthcare programs and housing programs that do have on-site for parts of the time navigators to help people get connected up with healthcare services, when it's right on-site as far as the navigators being on-site.
Yeah, we're starting to see a lot of our housing developers in Oregon incorporate community health workers into their resident services plans, even for 9% low-income housing tax credits. And often those community health workers are funded by their managed care organization, and they're they're either stationed on site at larger developments, or they're working in a scattered site model where economies of scale, you know, put them in that situation. But they're monitoring the healthcare needs, and as Mike said, they're helping connect residents to healthcare and other social services that they may need.
Thank you. So this next question is for Oregon and New Jersey. Are either of the states also working with their county jails to house exiting inmates? Are both working with their respective Department of Corrections, or is just one state doing that?
So in Oregon, we have a model that is working incredibly well. We're hoping to expand that model. So it's a supportive housing model for folks coming out of incarceration. And the organization is called Sponsors. They're considered a national best practice, and they've been incredibly successful. We just funded a second tax credit development, a 9% development for the organization. And they have the Sponsors as the service provider. They have a partnership with their local housing authority. There's Section 8 vouchers tied in. There is on-site services, including workforce services, parole and probation services. And like I said, they're incredibly successful. Obviously, there's NIMBY challenges with this population. They've been able to overcome those and garner community support. The Department of Corrections is very much involved with that as well. And we're working with the Department of Corrections, and then the agencies that have put this program in place to try and figure out how do we duplicate that, how do we take that model to agencies in other areas of the state of Oregon so we can bring it more to scale. Sponsors also recently received a HUD grant, a HUD and a DOJ grant combined, to help them try and figure out if their model can become a social impact bond or pay for success model, which they're currently exploring right now and they're using third sector capital as a consulting partner on that. And both Oregon Housing and Community Services and the Department of Corrections are involved in the group that is trying to see if that model could become a pay for success type model.
Thank you. And in New Jersey, last year we launched a 500 voucher Housing First program, and of that program, at least 100 of those tenant-based vouchers are targeted for people who are chronically homeless and frequent users of local jail systems. And in that program, we're providing the vouchers and a small amount of service funding, and providers administer this program for us. And part of being a successful applicant for the program was being able to leverage local service funding. And so we've had a few groups able to really leverage some new and existing local service funds to address this.
Yeah, and if I could just add there on New Jersey, Janelle, you know, so mental health is not necessarily represented on a call from New Jersey, but have provided some non-Medicaid dollars into local jail reentry and diversion programs, you know, for folks who may be linking up with sort of community treatment services or other case management services on release that would sort of fit in with this.
We also at DCA have a contract with two providers who operate several sites across the state that provide job training, other services for people who are exiting the prison system, and we do collaborate with Correction and Parole on that program.
Thank you. I'm not seeing any additional questions. We just have a few wrapping up comments, so feel free if you have a follow-up question, please submit it to the chat box and we should be able to come back to it. So I think the key takeaways that we hope you'll walk away from this webinar with, just regarding states that participated in the Cohort 1 or the 2016 IEP partnerships track, is that the track was helpful for states in obtaining buy-in from their agency leadership, as well as garnering additional stakeholder support. States were also able to identify new and leverage existing funding sources to support housing-related services and capital costs. HR also able to use data to drive policy recommendations and the development and design of supportive housing benefits, as well as identifying cross-system strategies for increasing community-integrated housing opportunities. So as we mentioned earlier, we are kicking off a cohort 2. We'll be working with an additional 8 states, or up to 8 states. Expressions of interest are due from states by midnight on June 8th. So just a few key dates. Expressions of interest should be submitted by midnight on June 8th. Between the period of June 12th and 23rd, CMS will hold what we call office hours calls with each of the states that expressed interest in participating. We expect the selection process and the initial kickoff meeting between the states and the and their lead coach or facilitator to occur in July. And then our official kickoff would occur in August here in D.C. It's an in-person meeting. And I think we should have dates for that. It would be August 22nd and 23rd. And I'm seeing the question here, will there be subsequent opportunities after cohort 2? I think we don't know yet. I think each year we sort of evaluate what would be the most helpful areas to focus on in terms of the provision of technical support to states. We're not sure. But if you're interested in participating and perhaps worried about the timeline, please feel free to reach out to us. So we do have our speakers' contact information. I do want to thank all of our speakers, Mike Morris, Kenny LaPointe, Joe Bongiovanni, and Janelle Winter. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us and to answer questions. If you're interested in reaching out to any of them directly, their contact information is on the screen, and these slides will be available on Medicaid.gov shortly after the presentation. I'm seeing another question. For the IEP application, is it okay to have a TBD or to be determined for some of the team members? I think for your additional members, so the expression of interest asks you to identify sort of core team members and additional. I think for your additional team members, it would likely be okay to have TBD. For your core members, I think it's going to be really helpful if you can identify those folks as early as possible. Just checking to see if there are any final questions, and I don't see anything, so I'm going to just thank everyone again for joining us for this national dissemination webinar. We do expect to have future national dissemination webinars that are focused on lessons learned as well as best practices that we've learned from participation in this track. Again, if you have any questions about applying for Cohort 2, please feel free to reach out to us. All of the information regarding Cohort 2 is available on Medicaid.gov. Thank you.